Welcome to the Reminger Report podcast on emerging technologies. Reminger Co. LPA is a full-service law firm with over 150 lawyers spread across 14 offices and serving states throughout the Midwest. My name is Zach Pyers, and I'm a partner in Reminger's Columbus, Ohio office.
And I'm Kenton Steele, an associate in Reminger's Columbus office.
This podcast on emerging technologies will examine how changes in technology and business models affect our daily lives and how the law is adapting to respond to these changes. This is the second part of our interview and sit down with Ryan McManus, founder and CEO of Share Mobility. During this part of the interview, we discuss the future of mobility and ride sharing as it develops over the upcoming years and decades. What do you see from being in the mobility space in the next 5 years? If you've got a crystal ball, what do you think some of the biggest challenges are kind of in this space? Not just for Share Mobility, but kind of just in the industry as a whole.
So I think the biggest challenge is perception of progress. I believe the automotive industry has a lot of de-innovation happening. You can look at electric vehicles. We're now in our third wave of electric vehicles, and the makers of them have done a pretty good job historically of ensuring that they're not successful. Okay. And you've got this promise of autonomous vehicles that, if you really know, it hasn't changed. The state of the industry in the last like 4 or 5 years hasn't really changed at all. But there's a lot of perception that it is. I think lobbying and status quo and trying to protect dealerships, current ways cars are sold, are all things that are going to hold back progress in this industry. I think from a policy perspective, we could get there a lot further. But the reality is we don't make the right vehicles today for the future that I'm trying to create. We are building cars to be bought by individuals to be driven 5% of the time and sent off to the junkyard after 10 to 15 years. They last a long time. You don't use them that frequently, and everybody's got their own, right? But if our new administration is successful in taking the Federal Transit Administration dollars and infrastructure dollars, and instead of putting 70% or more of that into roadways, they start putting that into equitable access services, public transit, improving mobility in rural areas, then it could create the demand for the automakers to start creating the perfect shared vehicle. And until we see automakers start to project fewer volume of sales in the future, we should all know that their intentions have not changed. Bill Ford wants to still sell more Mustangs and F-150s, no matter what he talks about Ford Plus, right? And if the automakers looked at what I said earlier about the value of time in the vehicle and monetizing all of the data, they'd realize that they could make more than 10 times the value of a vehicle sold by putting it into a subscription model. And you could be retaining these customers forever. Your lifetime value could multiply significantly. But they've got supply chain infrastructure and investments in manufacturing capacity that they have to depreciate. And so they've got a glide path that's longer than the glide path that I want. And so in the next 5 years, I think it's very much about affecting the things that could accelerate that glide path. Things I'm doing are we're just testing electric vehicles in our microtransit fleet. And I can already identify some challenges about how traditional ride hailing might try to use an electric vehicle and how they're going to be far superior in our model where we know all of the demand for the vehicle in advance, right? But if we can be demonstrating how to utilize shared electric vehicles and start to do it at scale, we can find the right automotive partner to eventually build the perfect shared vehicle.
That's a lot to take in. And as I'm kind of thinking through that, there's still, I think there's a lot of moving components that you kind of talked about there. from the autonomous vehicles. I mean, one of the things, as you're talking about the development, Kenton and I have often joked about just with the development of autonomous vehicles about how people always saying they were coming in 2020. And obviously 2020 came and went. And I know there was a pandemic, so I'm not trying to, but we still don't have fully autonomous vehicles. I know that Honda's releasing a level 3 autonomous vehicle in Japan. And we've got GM and Ford introducing level 2 plus services, or they've already had them. But you're right. I mean, we don't have a level 4 or a level 5, you know, fully autonomous vehicle. And I mean, the timelines as to when they may be out, I've seen various timelines anywhere from 2024 to 2030 to 2035. There's a lot of questions I think that remain out there about a lot of the things that you're talking about and whether or not, I mean, one of the things that, you know, that we've also talked about on this show too, and these episodes is that people, the Americans love their cars. And America has had a long infatuation with the automobile.
Yeah. Neil deGrasse Tyson was just on Joe Rogan, and they were talking about America's obsession with horses and cars. And I think people will always love driving, but they'll do that for pleasure. They'll go to a track. I see a future of, you know, dude ranch style tracks where you can go drive cars for the day. So if you really love to drive for pleasure, I think you're always going to be able to do that. So June for us is our five-year anniversary. 5 years ago, we started the company, and the founding vision was to build technology for a world where everyone is a passenger. And I always said three things. It's technology, policy, and behavior change. And I still believe policy is the thing that's holding us back. In 2016, I drove a Tesla across the country, and 59% of the time, I didn't touch the wheel. So we've had the pretty decent AV tech for a little while. It's the behavior change part that's the problem, right? We all buy our cars. We all have two of them. We drive them 5% of the time, and they last 10 to 15 years. So the changeover cycle of those vehicles isn't very frequent. It's one of the reasons why I focus not on personal vehicles but on fleet-owned vehicles because, for example, we've got a city up on the north side of town that we work with where we've taken one of the city-owned vehicles and we put it into our microtransit fleet. We're working on increasing the utilization of that. So instead of the life being, say, 10 years, it might only last 2. But I've got every bit of juice out of that. And we're able to bring in the next electric, connected, autonomous vehicle because we're accelerating this cycle of changeover. And then the last thing on behavior change that I think has to happen before we can have autonomous vehicles or we have the health scenario is planning ahead. We live in an on-demand world. My car's in the driveway so I can go get it. I hail an Uber on demand. I don't plan ahead. Well, if we all own our own autonomous vehicles and we're all hailing them on demand, the roads are going to be hellish because they're all going to be empty, driving around doing errands. They're doing errands for us personally. Those who have an economic need aren't going to have access to them at all. And because they're running around this neighborhood, they're not in a neighborhood that has more need. So the way that we're trying to affect this at Share Mobility is look at finding groups of people that will plan all of their transportation for the month and get more known demand from a group of people so that we can dedicate assets to serving those people and then they get to fractionally have mobility as a service, right? And so if I can get more people to just plan the commute. That's all I'm focused on is I just want you to plan your commute, plan the 40 trips you're going to take to and from work, do it through our app. I can save somebody $5,000 a year just by giving them a more efficient service if they plan ahead. And so my goal with Share Mobility is to partner with organizations that people already trust and bring them a tool that makes it really easy to plan the trip they take the most, which is their commute to work. And then we focus on those with a financial need first, and those like you that might be considering, like, wouldn't it be great if I did this? We'll get you later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I will tell you too, it's funny as you're talking about planning these trips, because I think about my own personal commute, and I roughly leave my house within a 5 to 10 minute window almost every day.
Yep.
You know, and so I think, couldn't I really I mean, my trip really is already kind of planned.
It is.
It's just a question. I mean, it's just a question of telling somebody else to come get me at that particular time yep. and making sure that I'm actually ready at that time. But pretty much already there as it is, my personal commute home varies a little bit day by day. But my commute here doesn't. And that's, I mean, so that's one of the things that you were thinking about, as I was thinking about, at least as you were talking about kind of planning ahead.
Right.
And I know that there's, I mean, I know that there's especially other industries or other professionals who have kind of a more set schedule.
Than probably
I do. Right.
Nobody books an airline on demand or I want to go to the airport now. they plan all that.
Absolutely.
I think the commute is something that you could very easily plan for, but it results in chaos theory where everybody is making slight differences on a day-to-day basis, 5 to 10 minutes. And it just means that rides that could have been shared don't get shared.
Right. Right. Now, I think you probably already talked about this a little bit when we were addressing kind of the challenges in the mobility industry, or when we were talking about, the challenges. Do you think there are any kind of opportunities or changes, at least in the near term, that you see in the mobility space? And kind of what do you think that near term may be? Because I know a lot of people, we were just talking about the autonomous vehicles. Analysts are kind of all over the place as to when we might actually see a high-level autonomous vehicle. But do you see anything that's happening kind of in the near term that, you know, we should be watching out for or kind of expecting?
So I think electric vehicles are a trend that is past the tipping point. So don't listen to my skepticism early on in the third wave. I think electric vehicles are here within the next 12 months. We're going to have 14-passenger electric vehicles that we can start putting into our fleet. And I think the need becomes electric charging infrastructure. We're doing pretty good in Columbus, but I think other parts of the country have a long way to go. The other thing is commuter benefits ordinances. And so I know there are some communities here in Central Ohio. I would love to see us do this at a city level in Columbus, and I think there's some interest in it, but it's a commuter benefits ordinance. So because of Smart Columbus, a lot of companies in the city offer commuter benefits, but nobody had ever thought of it. And a decade ago, Google started doing it, and they've got the Google bus, and they drive everybody to work. But there's a huge benefit in a city when all of the employers, especially the large ones, are making it easy for their employees to choose something other than an individual car and creating some incentives around that. And so there's only about 6 cities in the country right now, maybe 7, that have a commuter benefits ordinance. And I think that's going to be something that more and more cities take on as an action plan. And so in the same way that they have parking requirements when you're building a new building, I think you're going to see commuter benefits requirements. And it's easy to accommodate. You just put something in the new hire packet and you make sure every new employee knows their options to get to work. And then you can change the job application. It doesn't have to say, do you have reliable transportation? It can say, these are the options that we offer for you to get to work. And if we were successful in doing that, over a 5-year period, everyone in this city would hear about commuter benefits based on the normal rate of job change. And if you can catch somebody when they're making that decision to go to work, it's so much easier than trying to convince you to create a new habit. So day one, new job, this is how you're going to get there. Even if it's different than you've done before, you're starting something fresh. Getting you to change on day two is much harder. So I'm very bullish on the power of a commuter benefits ordinance to make all employers participate in helping their employees make that decision. And then commuting becomes like healthcare, where if you don't have it, you're not going to be able to compete. And everybody expects that a business offers commuter benefits.
You know, that it reminded me, because I listened to one of your podcasts recently. They were talking about the job car dilemma.
Yeah, quite a paradox, right?
Yeah. And how almost, because I think you at least alluded to this in your response about how most job applications say, do you have reliable transportation? But sometimes people need that first job in order to purchase the car, in order to have the reliable transportation. And so they may not need the job that they're trying to get if they already have the reliable transportation. So it's the chicken and the egg type of conundrum sometimes, not only from a mobility standpoint, but kind of from an economic development standpoint. And so I think that that's a really interesting – the commuter benefits is a really interesting area that could benefit not only, you know, a whole host of things, but could also benefit from an economic development issue.
I think that do you have reliable transportation is a veiled filtering question, and it's a discriminatory question. It's amazing that our legal system has allowed that question to stay in the job application, but do you have a car is not allowed because that's discriminatory. Why are we allowed to ask, do you have reliable transportation? Right? It's an outdated thing. I mean, do you know why every job application has that?
I don't. But I will also tell you that while I do some employment work, that's certainly not my primary focus. So
it's just something that every company has adopted as kind of a standard thing. I couldn't find any like origin case law or anything about why everybody does it, but it's a CYA thing. You know, yeah. Everybody knows if I ask it this way, I'm clear. If I ask it a different way, I might be discriminating.
Right. But
they're clearly discriminating by having that question in there.
Now I'm going to shift gears on you again, just because you and I had talked about this briefly before we started the show. But one of the areas that we oftentimes talk about in the ride sharing platform, and frankly, it's much broader than just ride sharing, but it really goes to the whole gig economy kind of structure as a whole, is the difference between independent contractors who usually receive a 1099 and employees who generally receive what we call a W-2. And I know that you've got some thoughts on this, and working in this space, we just kind of love to hear, you know, what your thoughts are. And I will also say too, as Kenton and I have talked about this, the landscape is kind of shifting and changing and sometimes rapidly. And frankly, there's still a lot of kind of what-ifs as it relates to some of the things that California is doing in introducing a potential third classification of worker. We knew that during the pandemic, we knew that some of the gig economy companies also were advocating for unemployment benefits for their gig economy workers. And kind of this whole, I don't want to say it's kind of a muddy mess at times, but this area where these people are falling. So since you're in this space, we'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
I don't understand the obsession with independent contractors and this perceived belief by a lot of investors that giving somebody a below living wage is a good business model. I do not understand how that became the status quo in the ride hailing and shared economy, gig economy, is that everybody is paid less than they're worth. I don't get that. I think it's a huge liability issue that the ride-hailing companies are trying to proactively do something about by working with lawmakers to establish the rules and set the rules. So they kind of went in and said, we're gonna break it. The rules don't exist. We'll figure it out on the fly. Different states do it different ways. But when it comes to the 1099 versus W-2 debate, there's billions of dollars in risked liability for the ride-hailing companies if any state was successful in getting the law passed that said all of these are W-2'd, because you have a look-back period. And you can go back, 7 years maybe? Is it seven? So you could go back 7 years. You could charge the ride-hailing companies the taxes, both sides of it, for every person that was a 1099 driver and say, now you're a W-2. That's billions of dollars of liability that could kill both companies. And so I think they're proactively trying to create new laws that ensure that that won't happen. I thought that they would create laws that move them into W-2 drivers so they could reset pricing. But they've already reset pricing, and the ride-hailing companies are in the process of killing themselves. They went from surge pricing when it was high demand to now it's a surge pricing on high and low demand. So if there's no one riding, or if there's a lot of people riding, you're going to pay more. And it's increasingly becoming something you can't use on a daily basis.
That's an interesting take. We've talked about it a lot in this space because there is an ongoing, from a tort liability perspective, there is an ongoing argument that people want to classify the drivers as employees to try to increase the potential liability against Uber or Lyft or the other ride-sharing companies or other gig economy companies just in general, frankly, so that they can tie, you know, the liability to them. So it's just an interesting, it's an interesting concept, and we always love to hear other people's takes on it, especially those in working in the industry.
I'd like to get your input on this, but you know, I think one of the things that needs to happen in mobility as a service and ride hailing is some kind of capped liability, almost in the same way that school buses have. You know, school buses are in an accident, I think it's $500,000 liability that they're capped at. And then it takes away the question of like how much liability is there and let's move it off to this guy and let's not take it. I think the operator should hold the liability, and the industry needs to get their stuff together and say, in a world of autonomous vehicles, the operator is the owner. It's not this like the car doesn't own itself, right?
Right.
But in the future, the operator will be the owner and the operator holds all of the liability. So cap that liability for the operator so that they don't have to price that into the service. That will just help those who need it.
You know, that so the issue, and I mean, I'll just tell you that the issue of like capping liability, as I'm sure you know this, is a policy decision that's made by usually our state legislatures, which is, I mean, which whether it's whatever, whether it's, you know, school buses or whether it's, you know, whether it's relating to punitive damages and in a particular case, or whether it's relating to municipalities, all those type of policy decisions, especially when it relates to capping liability, are almost all done by state legislatures. Mm-hmm. And so, but flipping to your other point as it relates to like autonomous vehicles, you know, that's another discussion that we've had. And because frankly, it's a little inconsistent at this time, because generally the way, and I'm sure you know this, is that when we talk about concepts and theories of tort law, they've almost always focused on issues of control. And so if I were to loan my car to Kenton and Kenton gets in an accident in my car because Kenton was controlling my car, and just for people who may not know this, Kenton is the co-host with me, who's usually on the show, but he's in the room with me today. But if I loan my car to Kenton and he gets in the accident, he is liable. Now, I may be liable for a different tort called as it relates to a negligent loaning my car to him. If I knew he was a terrible driver, it's called negligent entrustment. But if I didn't know that and Kenton had a clean driving record, then I probably wouldn't have any liability. It would be on him that's in control. So when we think about the autonomous vehicles, that shifts because, mm-hmm. you know, once we get to a higher level of autonomy, level 4 or 5, then I think the question becomes who is in control? And then who does bear the responsibility when that vehicle gets in that accident? So yeah, I think it's a very interesting point as well.
I think it still goes back to ownership and who's going to end up owning these vehicles. It's a question that I've asked on my podcast a lot that I've never gotten a clear answer. You know, everybody says like, well, I don't know yet, or we don't want to own the vehicles. I think that question needs to be answered because the vehicle ownership of an autonomous car is essential. We need to know how those are going to be bought. I don't think it makes sense for individuals to have to use them, at least not once you get to a level 4.
One of the things that we've heard, or is as you've said, is that this kind of concept of we'll see, one of the things that we've heard as touted or floated in the industries is relating to essentially ensuring that your car would come essentially with an insurance.
Yeah.
And so if I bought a fully autonomous vehicle from whoever, I mean, let's just say Honda. If I bought a Honda fully autonomous vehicle, it would come fully insured for the life of the vehicle. And so Honda would insure whoever was utilizing the vehicle for that time period, and that the insurance would essentially just be built into the car.
Yeah. You know, as I said earlier about some of the things I'm concerned about, I think insurance companies are one of the reasons why we are not making as much progress as we could. The commercial auto insurance companies are completely broken. They do not know what to do with this new model of mobility, and they do not want to see the 90% of their policies that are held in individual vehicle ownership moving to a model where they're held by fleets, because they're losing their shirt on the fleet business. They just don't know what they're doing. It makes such complete sense that you would package the insurance with the vehicle, especially if you're owning a large amount of them and you're doing the maintenance. future for companies like ours is really around self-insurance and captives and building a new model for commercial auto insurance, because I just don't see the industry doing it. I say that in a very insurance city.
Absolutely.
And if there was somebody at a leadership level with common sense around the value of this commercial auto opportunity, they'd be working with us.
It's interesting. Well, Ryan, we really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us today. And we look forward to seeing what's ahead for Share Mobility as the future goes on.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. I really appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk about this topic. And I think the next couple of years are going to be really impactful to determine how long it's going to take us to get to autonomous vehicles. But change is happening. It's just a matter of how long.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again. We appreciate it.
Thanks.